So now no one knows how many parking spaces there are in our country, but it's safe to say suburbs have an outsized number. It's where the majority of Americans work and live. We're discussing how to green up, how to redevelop the suburbs through a series of case studies of what works and why. Which architecture in suburbia needs a makeover? How do you wish you could change the design of your community's roads or buildings or parks? Conversation right here, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 for conversation. June Williamson is co-author of Case Studies in Retrofitting Suburbia, Urban Design Strategies for Urgent Challenges. She's an associate professor and department chair at City College of New York's Architecture School. June, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Why should we be focused on updating and modernizing our suburbs versus any other place, inner city, urban areas? Why reinvest in the suburbs?
Well, I think we need to look at the entire metropolitan landscapes, the built areas where North Americans primarily live. And for several decades now, the majority of Northern Americans have lived in the suburban parts of metropolitan areas. So it really isn't this area or that area. It's kind of all of the above. And given that for decades now, most Americans of all backgrounds live in different types of suburban areas, it's really important to look at how those places are changing and adapting and evolving.
Well, give us some working knowledge here. How do you define suburbs?
Well, there's lots of different definitions out there, for sure. And when we're looking at demographic data from the census and so forth, we are looking at the areas within metropolitan areas that are outside the center city. But for my research that I've been doing now for a couple of decades with my collaborator, Ellen Dunham Jones, who's a professor of architecture and urban design like myself, she's at Georgia Tech in Atlanta, we're really looking at suburban form and primarily at the places that have developed in the late 20th century or after World War II and into the early 21st century, no matter where they're geographically located. So there are some center cities in Northern America that have a lot of suburban form. That is places that where the buildings are set back of the street. It's pretty low density. It's oriented around cars with lots of large paved parking lots and an assumption that people are primarily moving around by car. So those are the places where we're looking at case studies for opportunities for retrofitting, especially when they've failed and become vacant.
Well, it's also interesting that if the streets are networked or interconnected or very walkable with a lot of intersections, that is what you would define as a more urban feel, urban form. Is that right?
Correct. Yes. So it's kind of, you know it when you see it. If things are interconnected, where there's a mix of different things, where you can do errands within a 5-minute walk, where it feels safe to ride your bicycle, those are the places that have what we characterize as a good urban form. And some places that may not be built out have parking lots have the bones of urban form. So small towns where they might have suffered in past decades because of the new shiny mall where buildings were torn down, older buildings were torn down and replaced with parking lots. Those places can be kind of infilled and resuscitated and kind of enlivened in ways. And then there are other places, and I know you have examples in Wisconsin where a failed mall that's 20, 30, 100 acres, so a pretty large piece of property, can come back in and restructure it, bring the buildings to the street, add sidewalks, and make blocks and have a mix of different things all in the same location.
Yeah, and you know, you consult on urban design all over the country. What are some of those barriers, those common obstacles to retrofitting projects that you see in the suburbs?
Oh, goodness. Well, There are many, many barriers. Some of them are systemic that have to do with, when I say that, I mean kind of rules and regulations and assumptions that were sort of put in place, codified, if you will, through zoning and other things a century ago in many cases, and they've just kind of persisted. So if you have a zoning that only allows one residential unit per lot, or doesn't allow commercial uses in a residential area or vice versa, then those things need to sort of, on the public side, might need to rethink some of those things in order to unlock the opportunities for new choices to be added. So that's one of the issues. Another has to do with some environmental things and sort of regulations that allowed wetlands to be filled and other kinds of things that have caused problems, or the lack of transportation options for people and the need to get investments to put that stuff back in. So some of this retrofitting, these are long-term projects. If it took 50 years to build out some of these places, it may take just as long in a kind of gradual, incremental way to retrofit them to better meet today's lifestyles and desires and demographics and kind of environmental expectations for building performance and so on. Yeah. But other retrofits can be done pretty quickly.
It just depends. June Williamson is co-author of Case Studies in Retrofitting Suburbia. It's a sequel to a 2009 book that aimed to show how suburban buildings could be redesigned into more urban, sustainable places. Did you grow up in the suburbs? What brought your family there? What are the benefits and drawbacks of suburban living? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll continue this conversation ahead with June Williamson right here on the Ideas Network. So now the suburbs, what calls to mind? Maybe strip malls, gas stations, maybe homes with two or three car garages. But this is fading in communities across the nation, with rezoning underway, greening up, better mass transit, all captured in 32 case studies in a new book on retrofitting suburbia. What retrofitting projects in Wisconsin architecture do you think we should know about? How have buildings changed over the years in your suburb? What redevelopments are in the works? Conversation right here, 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. We have architect and author June Williamson this hour as our guide to transforming the suburbs. June, you talk about road diets and walk scores and health impact assessments. And then there's this pressing question that it's big and bold. Can't we do something about all this traffic? What do we do about the cars in the suburbs?
Well, that is one of the six urgent challenges that we discuss at some length in this new book that we want to focus on. And we selected these 32 case studies because they were all exemplary in some way in addressing one or more of these challenges and layering really innovative and interesting solutions that we thought could be models for all sorts of other communities across the country facing similar issues. So of the six challenges, adding energy and water resilience, competing for jobs, leveraging social capital for equity, supporting an aging population, which is a big one of demographic change, improving public health by design, and then finally disrupting automobile dependence, which really is thinking about mobility and how we move around and providing more options, really, because a lot of suburban areas have been built assuming use of private automobiles and structured for that with wide roads and engineered for that. And there's lots of interesting ways actually to intersect some of these things. So redesigning streets, road diets, narrowing the paved areas can reduce traffic crashes and improve public health that way, because that's a major source of death and injury in this country. But also maybe create some space to add sidewalks, to add rain gardens, to better improve the managing of stormwater within neighborhoods and also in kind of more built-up downtown areas. So all of these things intersect in interesting ways. And we're thinking about getting more people to walk, and land use is really important for that, to use bicycles, so adding the bike lanes, and all sorts of different ways to think about transit, too, not just like a fixed commuter trains, but all sorts of ways that people can take short trips, and with maybe getting automated vehicles into the mix or autonomous shuttles, all sorts of things that could be kind of layered in to these existing neighborhoods to make them function better for all residents.
Yeah, you know, old habits die hard. You jump in your car, even if you're going that 1 mile, 2 miles, maybe even 3 miles. You know, you have to really change the way people approach transportation and think about how their community works.
Definitely, and works for everyone. So not just sort of the typical or idealized resident, but the whole range of people with different resources and abilities to drive and desires of where they need to go and when they need to go there. So that's another thing. I think these old stereotypes that people live in the suburbs and commute to work downtown, or assuming mostly families with children in the suburbs, all of those things the demographic data shows are much less common than they used to be. And so I think that's something we want to look at as well.
Yeah, we're aging fast as a nation. I mean, you point out that a fifth of the U.S. will be over 65 in less than 30 years. One of the things you advocate for are granny flats. What are those?
Well, that's a sort of colloquial way to talk about adding a second unit into an existing house or property. So it could be carving out part of an existing house. And let's say you raised a family in a house with multiple bedrooms, and then the homeowners are then empty nesters, and they've got surplus space in the house. And then they might still have an older parent in a previous generation, and people are living much longer lives, which is just wonderful, and living healthily in many cases. To advanced age. And maybe you could carve out part of that house to bring in your own parent, hence the granny flat, or perhaps share that dwelling with an older person. And it also could be a detached unit, so a little cottage in the backyard or something like that.
June Williamson, Associate Professor of Architecture at City College of New York, co-author of Case Studies and Retrofitting Suburbia. What does the future hold for shopping malls? Are they thriving where you are or struggling? How are malls adapting where you live? And how will the pandemic change suburban architecture? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll continue this conversation ahead with architect June Williamson. News update is next on the Ideas Network. Now we're taking a fresh look at suburban sprawl and how to redesign with walkability, public health, climate change, equity in mind. Architect June Williamson, she has consulted on many urban planning projects over the decades, thinks about all of this. One of her stats that jumps out, nearly half of the trips in the suburbs are under 3 miles, yet over 90% of these jaunts are made by car. How can we reduce our car dependence in suburbs? Is it possible? 800-642-1234. Conversation right here, 800-642-1234. June Williamson co-authored the book Case Studies in Retrofitting Suburbia, and she's our guide. June, we heard from Nancy in Rhinelander, called in, couldn't stay with us. Nancy wonders, what can be done about all the closed gas stations that Nancy sees in the suburbs? The land, Nancy says, can't really be used for anything else because of the gas tanks in the ground. What would be the next steps, Nancy asks.
Well, we do have a couple of examples in the book of retrofitted gas stations, and there's going to be thousands of them, I think, as the use of fueling private and collective vehicles changes. She's certainly right. They're brownfields, what we call brownfields, polluted properties. And so some expense needs to go into cleaning up those sites and removing the gas tanks. But we have one really fascinating case study in Quebec, in Canada, where a gas station was turned into a youth and senior center. And the sort of main office was for the youth, and the car repair area is for the seniors. And they made the whole building completely run on green energy. So the gas pumps are now converted into geothermal wells for getting the heat out of the ground. So So that's a really fascinating example that we have. But gas stations can be converted to restaurants and galleries and
other
things.
Oh, I have a favorite restaurant where I used to live that was a converted gas station. And while you could kind of feel the influence of the architecture that it had been that, you know, it was still a great, great restaurant.
Yeah. They can be kind of funky and maybe get rid of some of that asphalt and you have some open space in front for some covered seating. It can be really nice.
You looked at retrofitting, you know, malls in Minnesota, a pair of malls. Both were redesigned to address water runoff problems and to better support aging populations. How did they do that?
Well, those are two very different examples that we talk about. So the one in Maplewood remained a mall, but a tremendous effort was made to reduce the runoff of all the phosphorus and pollutants coming off of the paved parking lots and the roof of the building by putting in, I think it's about a linear mile of tree trenches. So just putting trees around the parking lot and using the soil under the trees to infiltrate the runoff from the parking lots made a tremendous difference in the amount of pollution coming off that site. And then an outparcel on that building that had been a Days Inn motel was converted into memory care senior housing for people with dementia. And so they could live there. And then right across the street is the public library with a crosswalk. They could cross the street and go to the library and a park space there. So that's one example. The other example, which is in Wayzata, a suburb on the other side of Minneapolis, a mall there on a smaller property, 14 acres, on a filled wetland, which was also polluting the lakes, it had completely failed. So it was demolished and replaced with a 5-block master plan of housing, a hotel, some restaurants, a town green with concerts in the summer. But a lot of the housing is for it's age restricted. It's apartments. It's a memory care, and it's all walkable because people can get from that site to the downtown. And actually, the sidewalks are heated for snowmelt.
Wow!
Without salt, which is important at this time of year, so that the older people feel comfortable going out and walking around the block, which is so helpful as well. To even just take a short constitutional walk.
Yeah, and certainly having those cleared paths and those that ability to walk and not slip or have uneven pavement, that is really important too, I would imagine, in the design of these spaces.
Yeah, and it's also important to compensate for one of the things that people have appreciated about enclosed covered malls over the years. There's the phenomenon of the mall walker who arrives even before the stores are open to walk around the concourses in a covered space inside the mall. So it is important, I think. We think of malls as these sort of cathedrals to commerce. And then when the stores close, a new mall gets built, there's nothing sadder than an 80% vacant mall, I would say. But how do we carry forward some of the social good of these places and the roles they played in the neighborhoods that have been built up around them? And so that's an interesting and important piece of retrofitting, is thinking about these so-called third places, not at home and not at work, but where people have social interactions and get some physical activity just in the course of their everyday lives.
We're talking about suburban architecture with June Williamson, co-author of Case Studies in Retrofitting Suburbia. Are you an architect or urban planner? What are your top concerns in retrofitting projects? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. June, another development, mall development, is the La Grande Plaza in Fort Worth, Texas. And I noticed, too, living in the Deep South, that sometimes churches take over dead malls. But they've done something different in Fort Worth. What is going on there?
Yeah, certainly churches, medical centers, community colleges taking over malls. These are all really interesting new uses for some of these spaces. The example of La Grande Plaza de Fort Worth was a mall that had been built in, I think, early in the 1960s. And it's been kind of rebranded and repurposed to reflect the changing demographics around it. So it's an an ethnic mall now serving the Latinx populations. And so there, the kinds of activities that they have, Mexican wrestling matches and concerts in the parking lots. And one of the anchor department stores that had been emptied out has been kind of broken up into hundreds of little stalls. It's like a mercado that you might find in a town plaza in Central America or in Mexico, with lots of small vendors that all have individual incubator businesses. And so people can pretty much get what they want in what had been one department store, now is hundreds of small stalls. Mm. So that's an interesting example.
Yeah, how can you make
sure... And great food, too.
I would imagine the food is amazing. And, you know, with all that culture and put that all together in one place, how do you make sure that these ethnic malls don't go away, that they'll continue?
Well, you know, that's something that I don't think can be ensured. And one of our findings of the retrofitting suburbia research over the years is that there is a continuous evolution. And some of these retrofits that are re-inhabitations or adaptive reuses may have a relatively short life, 10, 20 years, and then things continue to change and evolve. Some of the redevelopments, and this is what we think is one of the strengths, is if a large single one-purpose building or development, and this is also office parks as well, a corporate headquarters, is no longer suited for that use, if the urban design approach is made to break it up into smaller parcels, then it's more resilient over time and adaptable to selectively bring in new things as needs change. And so then we advocate that it'll have a longer life, a more prosperous life, that it isn't a kind of all or nothing proposition.
June, in what ways can suburbs upgrade quickly, make improvements quickly without costing millions of dollars and a lot of risk?
Well, I think some of it is just unlocking the opportunities by changing some of these regulations that codify assumptions about desires and needs that may not fit the actuality. So allowing those second units or the granny flats, and people don't have to build them and add them if they don't want it, if it doesn't make economic sense to them, taking away strict ratios of parking requirements for every new development and leave it up to those who are doing the development. Is this parking really needed? So just changing some of the regulations can be done as a way to prevent barriers and provide incentives, allowing other uses in properties and maybe giving some microloans to kind of get things kickstarted. I think those are the things that can be done quickly. Then there are other things like the examples in Minnesota where there's routine repaving that occurs on a regular cycle. And so that has to be done anyway. So the next time it's done, maybe the little bit less paving, adding sidewalks, adding some rain gardens, you're still able to move the cars through just as well. You have to spend the money anyway, and you don't have to spend that much more, and you can make these improvements in a routine maintenance kind of cycle.
I want to land on the pandemic. How do you see architecture changing in the wake of COVID-19?
Wow. Well, one of the findings that we've had, and we're still obviously in the middle of this, is that this experience is kind of intensifying and accelerating some of the trends that were happening anyway, certainly with respect to the closure of malls and the obsolescence of some of those development types, the office parks as well. So there's that. And then another piece, which is heartbreaking, is to see the kind of intersection of people who have already been made vulnerable with the kinds of chronic diseases that are endemic in Northern America that have been kind of enabled by the car. So the sedentary lifestyle diseases, overweight and so on. And so, you know, what we could do to try and counteract that and make people less vulnerable to disease is really important.
June, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me, Kate.
June Williamson is co-author of Case Studies in Retrofitting Suburbia, Urban Design Strategies for Urgent Challenges. If you missed part of our conversation, you can stream it, download it, wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.